Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome. Welcome back to Season 2 of the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of data, customer insight, data science, analytics, and AI. As I shared in the preview episode for this season, a new emphasis for these conversations is that we'll be digging deeper into some of those all-important softer skills. But introductions first. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Andrew Rogoyski. Andrew's experience spans 30 years in industry, government, and academia. Originally a physicist at Rutherford Appleton Lab, Andrew joined Logico at the height of the early AI boom, a decade later moving to space consultancy ESIS, and then became MD of Quintec's space division. Told you'd be an exciting guest. He subsequently worked as a strategist, including as secondment to the Cabinet Office, Vice President of Cybersecurity, where AI methods were again used for threat detection, and an innovation director developing a number of products and services that utilized leading-edge AI techniques. Andrew returned to academia as director of innovation at Surrey University's new Institute of People-Centered Artificial Intelligence. And there he leads a group that leverages the university's 35 years in AI by creating AI solutions that focus on delivering benefit to people and society. Definitely a much needed focus today. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you with us as well. I'm really looking forward to hearing from a guest with such a wealth of experience in the worlds of AI and research. You'll be a great extra voice for this community. With all my guests, Andrew, I like to first get them to give us a picture of their backstory, if you like, so listeners know where they're coming from, the experience they're drawing on. So I've obviously touched on elements of your CV, so to speak, with that intro, but could you please share with us your career journey, how you've grown into the work that you do today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's been a meandering path. Sometimes it feels I didn't start my life with an ambition to be any particular thing, other than perhaps I wanted to be an astronaut when I was young. And that seemed vaguely plausible in the late 60s, early 70s. Mm. I guess science has been my driver throughout my life career. It's always been my great curiosity. And it's been ways that I've managed to navigate through my career to kind of keep that alive. And so it is a great pleasure to return to academia after starting off there so many years ago, after quite a few sort of intervening experiences.
Absolutely, absolutely. And do you see that as having really strengthened your scientific role within academia? I'm guessing that it's a help to your work that you've got so much experience of what in the private sector we might call client side and supplier side demand, experience, needs for this kind of intelligence.
I've always liked to think that actually it goes two ways, that my sort of scientific technical bent has helped me in my business environments. And that my business knowledge is certainly helping my academic colleagues at the moment. And it's kind of fundamental to my role within the university, within the AI Institute, is to build those bridges between the academic team, the researchers here, and outside organizations. And I think nowhere is this as important as in AI, or no field is it as important, because so much of AI is being done in industry, by industry, for industry's purposes. Yeah. And actually bringing that awareness, that understanding of how external organizations, commercial organizations operate, and what their interests are likely to be, is really valuable to some of my academic colleagues who have to work with outside organizations, but may not have had any direct experience themselves. Probably the majority of them have no direct commercial experience. And so it's always a little bit of an unknown factor for them. And being able to sort of point them in the right direction and give them a bit of guidance, I like to think that they find very useful.
Good. That makes sense. And I wonder, did you find that you talk about return to academia with your role there at Surrey University? Did you find that it felt completely new to you after all those years out in government and private sector work, or was it quite familiar? Was it like coming home after your start in academia?
That's an interesting question. I guess many elements of it felt familiar. Some elements had changed. When I started my sort of early academic life in the Rutherford Appleton lab, It was at a sort of government lab. It was working with international teams. It was national facilities. The truth is that I found myself spending an awful lot of time programming a gray supercomputer, which is what got me into the sort of the tech tramline originally.
Yes.
And coming full circle back into academic AI, there's many things that surprise me, some things that are very much the same. So I think after working many years in sort of commercial and government sort of sectors, one of the things that I find really good is being able to be open about what we do, and a very strong sort of multicultural environment where we have all nationalities, a very diverse research base. And it's a really real pleasure to work with some very different minds in academia. And I think that's moved on since I was first in academia. And I think it's a really powerful step in the right direction.
Great. That certainly does sound like it. Thank you, Andrew. And I guess I've had other guests on here, a number as I reflect on it, actually, in series one, who came from a scientific background, many choosing to make the switch to data science, but with a background in a whole range of different sciences. What attracted you to the work in AI? You talk about this early passion, like many young boys, I imagine, can relate to if they're of a certain generation, to be an astronaut. Why were you drawn to the work in AI in particular? Because you've been working it long before it's fashionable.
Yeah, that's true. I've dipped in and out of AI throughout my career to a greater and lesser extent when it was and wasn't fashionable. I think alongside, fascination with space, which is quite a common fascination, I think, among people with a sort of technical bent. I think one of the other very frequent fascinations is with the idea of artificial minds. What makes our own minds work? Can you recreate a machine that thinks like human beings? They're the subject of science fiction and have been for decades, actually millennia probably, if I think about it. The ancient Greeks had a line on that. It's one of those recurring questions that I think a lot of sort of technically inclined, inquiring minds always think about AI. And so I think when I was choosing my PhD, I had done quite a lot of work on at the time. My first degree was in physics and astrophysics, so pursuing my sort of space dimension, if you like. And I was intrigued, and I was looking for something to do with AI, but there was very little in academia at the time. UK academia had suffered a bit of a downturn because of a famous report that had said basically AI was a waste of time, and the UK government had pulled the plug on a lot of AI funding. And so there was the sort of first AI winter in the late 70s. It wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s that we had another sort of foray into AI, by which time I'd done my PhD. But I was still fascinated and got into it, re-entered it, if you like, through my supercomputing skills, as it were, that led me into industry.
Yes, no, that makes good sense. I joined you on the second wave, I guess. My own experience was I was working in R&D teams for major bank, and was working with neural networks and fuzzy logic and case-based reasoning at that second heyday. So I was going to touch on the subject of the AI winter, actually. I didn't see the first one so much, but certainly the second, where all that enthusiasm for the potential of neural networks, and we were still talking about expert systems in those days as well, kind of waned, and it was seen as not having delivered on its commercial promise in many people's minds. Did you experience that, or did you just keep plowing your own canal, so to speak, on this, and you believed still?
So there were definitely some successes that I experienced. I was part of a team. I was systems engineer for a big expert system that we did in the first company I joined called Logica.
Yes.
And that was really fun and exciting. We were breaking barriers there. It was probably the largest expert system that Logica had ever implemented. Mm. And at the same time, we were doing research in early neural nets. These were tiny neural nets. I almost hesitate to call them neural networks in comparison to what's viable nowadays. Genetic algorithms, age-based systems, and some of the things that you mentioned. There was a lot of different options and different ideas kicking around in that age. And I think, well, expert systems failed to deliver. They were the big hope, and a lot of money got invested in them by various corporates and others. But they ran up against the cost of maintainability, which is the thing that killed them off, essentially. You know, if you build a system that's dependent on extracting knowledge out of human experts, that's fine when you do it once. But when you have to keep going back to those human experts to say, okay, here's a new situation, how do you program for that? It gets very expensive very quickly. And a lot of the big expert systems that were developed sort of fell by the wayside. So it wasn't that people turned off. It's just that people realized that actually it's a lot harder than I think everyone hoped. There was a lot of hype. And, you know, people who've been through hype cycles, there is an element of hype with the current AI.
Indeed.
But, you know, there's a lot of really hard science and engineering that needs to be done with those. And I think, you know, other things overtook it at the time. So I think it sort of waned in interest before it came back again in the sort of the early noughties.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm also interested in your work with government. I guess a number of guests I've had on here have had strong backgrounds in academia, strong successful careers within the private sector, some touched into public sector, but I don't think another guest has worked so strongly within government as you have. Is that a very different environment again? I guess from the outside as a citizen, it sometimes feels like not enough emphasis is happening from the government to prepare our nation for the potential and dangers of AI. Do you see that as a very different part of your career, or an area that was fairly familiar and easy to help as well?
I think it was both different and familiar. I'd done work with various government organizations over the years in the defense community, the national security. So I knew it from the outside, as it were, as an advisor, as a supplier into those communities. But an opportunity came up for me to be seconded into the Cabinet Office, or specifically the Office of Cybersecurity and Information Assurance, the cyber gang, if you like, who were running the National Cybersecurity Program, which was a big, you know, nearly £1 billion spent over a few years by the government then to promote cybersecurity across different government departments. So a really sort of substantial initiative to really get a government house in order on cybersecurity. And I was seconded into that to be part of their team as an industry and technology advisor. And it was, I thought it was a great privilege, actually. I worked with some really delightful people, very bright people, a lot of, dare I say, Treasury people there who were very bright, who hadn't really got either a strong technical instinct or hadn't understood how industry was would behave and was structured. And in the same way as industry sometimes treats government as a sort of monolith that is a single organization with a single behavior, I think that, you know, the reverse was true. And, you know, many I learned that actually, government departments are very different with their own different cultures, and their own motivations and so on. They are like different companies in a way. Right. And I hope I got across to many of my colleagues at the time that, that industry didn't behave with one voice, and there were many different factions and different behaviors and so on. And it was great fun. It was a real insight, spending my time on Whitehall, wandering from the Cabinet Office to the Foreign Office, the MOD, to other government departments at the time, meeting ministers and so on. It was a fantastic experience, one I really treasure.
Good. That is good to hear. Great. Well, I think we've well established your credentials, Andrew, in terms of both your academic understanding, your practical experience, and your experience of working with such a diverse range of stakeholders, I guess is the language I would use, both in terms of technical expertise and within the private, public, and academic spheres. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast episode, a pivot, I've fallen into the Americanism, that I've made with season two of this podcast is this emphasis on softer skills, trying to draw out from the technically expert leaders who I have on this show what's helped them in the people skill and the softer skill regard. So let's test this with you as well. Which softer skills or people skills, to take your preferred nomenclature, have you found to be important to your growth as a leader and your success in this career?
That's a really interesting question, and I think a lot of people need to think about some of these, some aspects of this. Mm. A little bit of backdrop before I answer directly.
Sure.
One of the things in my career trajectory was to work with, as you say, sort of some name corporates with a Cabinet Office, but I also worked with three SMEs, so small companies. And I think that, that getting that understanding of what makes a large corporate tick, what makes a, 20-person company tick, getting those different perspectives, I think is really valuable. And I recommend it to people. Mm. Because working in a small company is very different from working in a large company. Mm. The reality of whether you're all going to get paid at the end of the month, things like that in a small company sharpens your focus on things. But to go back to your original question, I think the sort of soft skills that when I sit back and think about it, I guess there's two or three that I would sort of highlight as valuable to me. The first is that served me well, I think, is the role of sort of technology business translator, to be a bridge between those two ecosystems. Very often you find that the science and engineering community, who are really important in technical companies, speak a different language, think a different way from the business leader community that are driving and shaping that company.
Yes.
And I think having an appreciation of how both communities think and what motivates them and so on is really important, and is, I found, surprisingly rare. So people who genuinely understand the sort of technical side of things, but also genuinely understand how businesses work. Mm. And very often, the vast majority of people I've ever met fall in one camp or the other.
Yeah.
And rarely bridge the two. I guess my second one would be something around, this is almost a personal one, is around connectivism and creativity. So being able to spot relevance from different ideas, different fields, different domains, and connect people and ideas and technical approaches to come up with new ideas, new approaches. And I think that's a sort of creative role. And I'm a great advocate of multidisciplinary approaches, because you find that people with different perspectives, different backgrounds, as long as they're not just talking past each other, they're open to it, that they're open to sharing ideas and thinking about the perspectives of the other people, is a really powerful way to be creative and innovative. And then I guess my third one is something about being a bit of a gentle contrarian, as it were. Something that just challenges yourself and others to sort of say, well, why do we think that? Is that necessarily true? There are a lot of decisions that get made on assumptions. There are a lot of technological developments that get made on assumptions. Mm. We think that that's always the way that it's done. And sometimes the ability to sit back and sort of say, maybe it doesn't have to be that way, is really valuable. And it's quite a subtle one, that there are lots of people who will argue for the sake of arguing, but people who will just sort of pick on the right points and sort of say, why do we think that's still the case here? And what happens if it's not? Is a very powerful way to be innovative, I think.
Yes, those are great answers, Andrew. Thank you. There's lots there I find fascinating, both in terms of what you refer to as connectivism. I think that you mentioned it connects to me, excuse the pun, with your earlier reference to the diversity that you value at the moment in the institute you're working in. And from the way you described it, it did sound like you've got what Matthew Syed would call cognitive diversity, not just superficial diversity. And I'm a big fan as well of the power of polymaths, the power of people with different understanding of different worlds, and having that breadth of exposure and that openness. And what you said at the end as well, that reminds me of the genesis of the devil's advocate label within the Catholic Church, and the people who will positively, in order to help, take on the role of challenging and potentially trying to break down an argument, but not from a combatant perspective, from a constructive perspective. So it's very helpful. I wonder, out of those three then, and they are three really interesting ones, so thank you for sharing that. If I pushed you to choose one between that translator role, that connectivism, and that gentle contrarian, I think was the language that you used, it's rather beautiful. Which of them would you say has been the most powerful to you, the most use to you over your career?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I would say I'm going to slightly duck the question by saying I enjoy the connectivism and the creativity. That's what really gives me a buzz, is being able to see ideas that pull other people's ideas together. That I really enjoy that. Mm-hmm. But I would suspect that I live off the ability to translate, to bridge between the business and the technical world, and that's where all my roles largely have really come to the fore. You know, where I've been most valuable is when I've been able to bridge those communities. And I think it's also quite difficult, as I said earlier, that it seems to be surprisingly rare. I don't know whether that's still going to be the case in the coming years, but people who can speak tech and speak business, genuinely interested in both, because it's there are people who fake it, and it's very easy to spot a fake. And you know, if you're talking to an engineer or a scientist and you're trying to fake knowledge of their field, it's very obvious. And likewise in business. So you know, being genuinely interested in both sides of that, and being able to connect it up and to cross explain, to translate, I think is probably the one that I've earned my living from.
Yeah, that's a good explanation, and I fully accept that as the caveated selection in that kind of case. And let me just agree with you. I think it is very rare, and I like the way that you pull out the genuine interest in both sides. I think that's the driving force of it that many lack, that they can push themselves to do a level of learning some business language, or they can push themselves the other way to have a superficial understanding of technical depth and the work that's possible. But if someone's going to keep up the continual learning and development and just natural curiosity on both sides, they have to actually find both sides interesting. And I think from my experience, that's what's rare. People can fall into translator roles, but still primarily take their identity out of, I'm a technical person who has to do a bit of this, or I'm a business person that has to do a bit of this. It's rare for someone to love both sides and actually find both fascinating. So maybe it does come back to some extent, I'm just wondering, Andrew, to your connectivist point, at least in terms of the kind of polymath label, that people who can be genuinely interested in a range of domains, do you think they maybe have more tendency to do this?
I think that's right. I was just thinking about the sort of slightly meandering course of my career. And I think what's always driven me is interest. You know, there's been, you know, the reality of the shape of the role and things like that. But, you know, under the surface, I'm going, is this going to be interesting? Is it going to fascinate me? And I think that you're absolutely right. I think you have to have that sort of genuine sense of you know, curiosity and hunger to acquire that knowledge, to be able to play with those ideas in your mind and share them with other people.
Yeah, good word, hunger. That continual drive, not just an early one-off. Given we're keen to explore then what you've learned about this translator skill, and translator skill would be rather disconcerting, and how others might get better at this or focus on it, I wonder, did you have a role model? Lots of people who find that a skill really serves them well or they get really good at something have been inspired by seeing someone else who was good at it and kind of seeing the potential. Did you have a role model who you thought, wow, I can see now the need to be a translator?
That's interesting. I think the most obvious role models, and I see some of them on a day-by-day basis at the university, and sometimes I don't see them, are people who, you know, I've seen some great academics who can really turn a subject, possibly a dry and complex subject, into something that's fascinating and easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think those sort of teachers who really, to me, the ones who are the best are the ones who truly master their subject and then can explain it at any level in a way that fascinates the listener. And I think of most examples of those in the sort of the academic community. I can think of some truly awful ones too, who, you know, hoard the knowledge, as it were, make a subject as difficult and as abstruse as possible, to promote their own self-worth, perhaps. I don't know. But people who really, really make that effort to be a bridge. And, you know, there are famous examples like, for example, Richard Feynman, a very famous physicist, but also a very famous explainer. So someone who could explain incredibly complex leading edge ideas to people who had no background in physics and science. And to really interest them, inspire them, make them laugh, and fascinate them. I think then, since then, some of the people I've met along the way, or I, you know, there are third party public figures. I've always been a fan of the Apple, the company. I've been fascinated in its turnaround since the 90s.
And yes, indeed. Yeah.
I have a great deal of respect for Tim Cook as the person who took over from, the Steve Jobs legacy, as it were. So having led the company to where it got to with someone who was very charismatic, very driven in the form of Steve Jobs, to then come from the operational side of the business and to lead that company to, ever increasing greatness. You know, it's one of the most valuable companies in the world now.
Yes.
I remember saying that back in the 90s, saying I think Apple has not seen its true day, you know, and talking to people, my colleagues, that are saying, you're mad, Apple will cease to exist in months, you know.
Yes.
How wrong they were. But I was wrong about other companies too. But, I think he's an interesting example of someone who's driven the company not only to huge success, but also has a strong sort of ethical stance on things like privacy and accessibility and so on within the products that they make. So I sort of cite, I think of him as an example. And then I had a boss. Well, I've had the same person as a boss twice in my career, some years apart. And he was the one who, he's not a translator so much, but he was the gentle contrarian. And it took me quite a long time to realize that was his thing, as it were. And he would just quietly inject these questions into conversations, into decision making, and so on, that you know, it was only in retrospect that I realized quite how powerful that was and how useful it was. So, you know, someone that I sort of think of as actually there's an aspect there that I've learned from that I've adopted.
Great, great. That's a nice examples. Thank you. Thank you for sharing them. I guess if I'm thinking about the listeners to this podcast, I can think of many people with a great deal of technical expertise, some working in the fields of AI and other related data science disciplines. And part of their challenge back might be, I hear you, Andrew, I hear you, Paul, as to the power and importance of this, but my whole time is filled trying to keep up to speed with my technical field. You know, how can I possibly find the time to hone this skill as well, or to understand the business side or the organizational side? How have you managed it, Andrew? Have you managed to, in order to be an effective translator, understand both sides of that equation and find the time to do continuous professional development, whatever it is, that's helped you keep knowledge sufficient on both sides of the equation?
Gosh, I think the truth is that I don't manage it. And I think the truth is that nobody manages it in something like AI. There is so much going on. You know, a fire hose doesn't begin to describe the volume of work that's being done in this area. So you have to pick your sources. I think you start off by having a very strong sense of curiosity. You have to be, you know, it has to be motivational in your DNA, as it were, to want to find this stuff out. It doesn't mean that you dedicate every hour of every waking day to, subjecting yourself to more knowledge input, but you have to be constantly on the lookout for interesting things that you come across them, whether you're listening to the radio, the podcast, whether you're reading the paper, whether you're reading scientific journals, whatever it is, you know, your antenna will twitch. That's an interesting idea. I'm going to file that away because that's important. I can do something with that. You just have to be constantly, if you like, vigilant. And I think, you know, nowadays, although the volume of material is up, there's great sources of aggregation, such as podcasts, being able to listen to people's opinions, their own views, their own knowledge as aggregators.
Yes.
Is a very good way of getting authentic opinions and ideas, that you can play with. And it's also tremendously convenient. You can do it while commuting or going for a run or whatever you do in your spare time. So it's not just book work, it's other forms of consumption, as it were, knowledge growth. But as I said, you have to have that curiosity. And I think as part of my curiosity, I've always been fascinated by what comes next. You know, what does the future hold? So I've sort of amateur dabbler in futurism sometimes to sort of think about, what the world of the future might look like. And I think that combined with the curiosity in fields like AI is absolutely, you know, it's wonderful that we're right at this tipping point for probably the most powerful technology that humankind has ever invented. And all of the different outcomes, benefits, and challenges that we face going forward is absolutely fascinating. And I can't keep away from it.
And it sounds like it as well. It's great to have that enthusiasm. Lovely evocative terms there. I love the antennae being out and twitching and the restless curiosity. They make good sense. I wonder if you have a best example of where this skill has helped you. So this translation skill, the power of being genuinely interested in and understanding both the business and the technical, would you have an example you could share with us where that's really helped you out? It's worked really well?
I think there's probably, thousands of little examples that throughout my career has sort of been helped by, my innate curiosity and willingness to engage on the technical side and then being able to translate that on the business side and vice versa. I can't necessarily pin it to one big thing, but there are everyday examples where I've been able to translate, and it always gives me a bit of a kick to sort of do that and sort of see the light come on both sides and see the respect grow on people realize, what each other are talking about, and that there's a relationship then that's formed and bonded as people realize they're all on the same side. It's a slightly woolly answer, I think, it's living it every day. I think what I do see, and this is one of the reasons why I came back to academia, is the is inspirational teaching and the force multiplier that represents. If you can apply that translation skill and see the young minds be inspired, grow in understanding and ambition and so on as a result of the things you say and the ideas you portray, then I think that's tremendously worthwhile and is a thrill. When you see people in the early 20s and so on, it's really excited about an idea as a result of your ability to explain it. That's tremendous kick. And I see other people within university environments, not just at Surrey, who are really good at it and who do inspire their students. It's a great responsibility because you're shaping and changing, a young life, people who are going to have hopefully fruitful careers for many decades to come. And to be able to give them, any kind of help in the right direction, I think is a real thrill.
That's great to hear. What a warm call to this vocation, and perhaps people on the podcast, those who are listening, those who have appeared before, maybe some others will be inspired to also have that opportunity and return or arrive at academia for the first time to get that kind of joy of opening up young minds, as you say. Given that you don't have one example, Andrew, I wonder whether averaging is always a danger, but most of the time, would you say that you experience the need for the translation skill equally on both sides? Or is it mainly that the technical community is making an effort, but the non-technical audience doesn't come halfway, or the other way around? Do you see one side of the community or the equation, as I put it before, needing translation unfairly? Or do you think this is an equally balanced need in your experience?
That's a good question. I think it's a balanced need. I think both communities struggle sometimes to follow each other, understand motivations and so forth. So I wouldn't say one was guiltier than the other. I would say that what they're guilty of is assuming that they understand the other. I've known many business leaders who thought that they understood the technology and completely sort of miss the mark. And vice versa, technical people who say, oh, this business stuff is easy, all you have to do is X, Y, Z, and who don't understand the complexities of running a business and growing a business. So the volume, the numbers may not be quite the same. Typically you're looking at a sort of pyramid structure, which, the business people are less in number than the engineering, but I think in terms of person per person, I think it's just different communities, and I'd extend it into other fields too. It's not just business technology; it's other things that we have to think about, like diversity and otherwise. People think that they get it, but actually, sometimes people need to, you need a third party to explain why it's important, and then the light bulb comes on and you get it.
That makes sense. It's a fair answer. Final question, Andrew, and thank you. It has been lovely to talk to you. I've really enjoyed this. I try and, in this new investigation of softer skills, avoid some of that hype cycle that you talked about before by giving an opportunity to put some limits around things. So what about a health warning in this regard? Do you see any cases from your experience where people shouldn't try and use such a skill as translating, where it isn't helpful, it isn't the approach to take? Is there a limit here?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It's that there is a line of judgment, I think. I think generally it is useful to be a translator and be able to translate. And it's always useful to have that discussion in which translation, in which you're making sure that you're talking all the right languages. And in this, I would go so far as to say, you're not just talking about the business dimension or the technical dimension, but you're talking about the customer dimension, supplier dimension, all of the different stakeholders. You have to think that people have different points of views and different cultures and different priorities and so on, and be able to sort of empathize with all those different communities, I think is very important. However, you do reach crunch points, and sometimes you reach personalities that don't get it or don't want to get it. You know, I've come across leaders who want to be leaders, who want to be bosses, and are not open to persuasion or reason sometimes. Sometimes because they have to be that way. Sometimes it's a personality trait. They just want to be the person in charge who makes the decisions and don't want to listen to reasons why they might be wrong. And I think that's where the judgment comes in. You know, that I have crossed that line more than a few times where I've tried to explain to someone that they're wrong with, you know, what I regard as impeccable logic. It really falls on deaf ears, and I'm kind of missing the cue that that person really doesn't want to listen to the explanations. They've made their decision and they want to move on with it. And you have to know when to draw stumps, when to quit. And no amount of persuasion and logic will change that situation. It actually becomes quite damaging if you push it too far. So, there are some lines in the sand, as it were, not always immediately apparent, where you have to say, all right, I've done my best, I've tried. But at the end of the day, you know, it's their role to make that decision. I'll step back from that. So that would be my advice, is for people to just be conscious where they are pushing it a little too far, and they're taking persuasion into the realm of sort of, you know, badgering and not helping their case.
Makes sense. God, we are back to the wisdom of not casting your pearls before swine. There we go. What a lovely way to end. That's great, Andrew. Thanks for your thoughts. Many thanks for the experience that you've shared with us today. It has been an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure. Made me think of a whole bunch of things that I'm going to do over the coming months and years. So I hope your community gets something out of this. It's been a real pleasure.
Great. I'm sure they will. And I'm glad to have given you some dots to connect. And thank you, everyone, also for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And there's also regular content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains for me to say thanks again to everyone for your time. Have a great week. And perhaps you can reflect on that translator skill that Andrew raised with us. Do you have restless curiosity that you could be feeding? Could you be developing and playing to this skill more? Or do you recognize that you don't have it and you need to look to collaborate with others who could help you and your team be more effective in that regard? Lots to think about. Have a great week and bye for now.